Chapter 2. The Wake-Up Call. Hang the kulaks, successful peasant farmers. Execute the hostages. Do it in such a way that people for hundreds of miles around will see and tremble. Lenin. My political awakening began in the early 1970s when I was still in school shorts. I was in the library when I stumbled across a fantastic pre-internet news source called Kiesing's Contemporary Archives, which was a non-partisan journal for libraries and the like. I seem to remember that it contained no adverts, and it just reported the facts without any slant, not something you will see much of today. I always loved history, and this rather naturally led me into keeping an eye on contemporary events such as those Kiesing's covered. However, even though I was a serious student of history, I gave it up in my early teens as the lessons seemed childish and trivial when compared to what I was already studying in my own time. I have continued to enjoy reading history out of personal interest and to understand politics and the world around me. The wider I have read, the more connections and links I have made, including understanding my own ignorance and the blind spots I would have if I specialized in one area alone. Sadly, college students now study less widely than they did in the past, with their first year no longer providing as broad a base of knowledge on which to found their specialist choices and their development as thinkers, individuals, and citizens. We can see the price being paid now that our top colleges are turning out expensively educated idiots as certain in their judgments as a Sharia jurist. This tragic situation is best illustrated by the fact that when I was young, a UK student with decent A levels was deemed equivalently qualified to an American with a degree, hence the brain drain as young Brits headed west. Strangely enough, the event that pushed me out of the rut I was set to stick in is certainly more familiar today than it was at that time. One evening, when I was delving into the archives, I scanned an item mentioning the death of millions of Ukrainians in a famine engineered by the Soviets under Stalin. I was taken aback, at first thinking that I was misreading things, that they must have been referring to the Jews killed by Hitler. But I soon realized that they were not referring to the Holocaust, but to another event known as the Holodomor, which had preceded Hitler's genocide of the Jews. This realization that the Nazis were not alone in purposefully killing many millions of civilians was a complete surprise to me, in fact, a reset to my entire way of thinking. Why did all of us, as schoolchildren, know about Hitler and his atrocities, but knew next to nothing of communism's murderous bent? I soon learned that Stalin had outstripped Hitler in his murderousness, thinking little of having to put away 20 million or more to establish the great socialist utopia he sought. It seems to me that the paths to these wonderful one worlds are littered with the bodies of countless millions and the graves of the empires that culled them. This minimizing of the crimes of the left, whilst continuously drawing attention to those of the right, sound familiar, made me aware of the power of omission, especially the conscious avoidance of evidence that sheds light on a guilty secret. I also came to learn that Stalin was by no means alone in his single-minded pursuit of a 20th century heaven on earth, a focus, oddly enough, of my fellow atheists. The list of those intellectuals in the West supporting him in his drive to eradicate the bourgeoisie, the kulaks, and class enemies was long, and many seemed little troubled by his blood-soaked record. Demands for the killing of millions were expressed by such figures as George Bernard Shaw, apparently a great intellectual, just not the warmest of human beings. Being the son of a sergeant in the Royal Air Force, RAF, and the grandson of a World War II veteran, I had a practical rather than an intellectual perspective on these things, and I learned to listen carefully and to search deeply when facts were spouted in arguments supporting extremists of any type. Since my eyes were first opened, I have never lost my interest in the quest for the reality underlying myths and political obfuscations, always seeking out the details that can strengthen or scupper an argument, even those threatening my current worldview. This questioning and searching mindset led me to my future career choice, gaining a commission in the Intelligence Corps and spending 16 years getting paid to do interesting work. Obviously, it was my job then to study the thoughts of the enemy, reading what they had written and studying the sources they had studied, and not just relying on our own manuals on their doctrine, so it was easy in those days to sing the praises of our then freer system. But after the Berlin Wall crashed down and the threat diminished, my foot could come off the gas, and I was able to look around and reevaluate things. This process took many years, but that's because I actually do fact-check, as the thousands of books I pored over attest. Even so, my knowledge is very limited, with some silos quite full and others with their base barely covered. Basically, the strategist can be viewed as someone who uses a walkway across the top of a collection of knowledge silos, dipping into those they think contain what they seek, thus forming an incomplete but wider perspective than can an occupant of a single silo. Being stuck in one and unable or unwilling to dip into others naturally leads to a narrower perspective. Silo occupants are tacticians, learning their trade and proving themselves before those who have shown promise are hauled onto the walkway by the old strategist, another one-time silo occupant. If your schooling and life do not develop critical thinking skills and tolerance of the views of others, you end up with what now we see in the West, banishing heretics and stealing rights. Doing so makes people more easily led by the financial interests and the ideologically inclined elites, and that's the plan. The less material the brain must work with on political, social, and economic matters, the less able we are to counter the intentions of those who design and run the system. There were a number of countries in my younger days that were controlled by fascistic-tending parties and military juntas, including those running South Africa, South Korea, and states in South America, but the death tolls and terror inflicted by them paled into insignificance when compared with those of the far left. After all, around the time that I had been born, Mao had managed in his great leap forward to starve to death more than 45 million Chinese. His attempt to go one better than the Soviets in their collectivization project, sadly, with even more deadly results. Dakota, 2011, PS 333. However, this was somehow glossed over by the use of a fancy slogan, and some people swallowed it, as they did with the mass murder less than a decade later in his Cultural Revolution. Simple maths could guide any reasoning person to understand this, but words seem to mean more to many people than does misery. One only has to look to the intellectual giants, the white college kids of the New Left in 1960s America. They fell for the hard left's utopian drivel, and more still do today, with Black Lives Matter, BLM, demonstrating the efficacy of the three-word slogan, "Bend your knee." It doesn't matter whether the word salad is true, just that it hits the spot. This is the major psychological lesson in life that I have learned: forget reason and think emotion. First, gauge your assessments on how people might view things based upon their emotional responses, and this is supported by much weighty research. Wrangham, Richard, Patterson, Dale, 1996, p. 183. Again, that's just how things are, though we can all fool ourselves that this never includes us, because we are so damned smart. This thinking has certainly helped keep me in the political center as a strong supporter of democracy, but events have proven that nice-sounding moral, though largely vapid, arguments supporting the left will always have an appeal beyond reason, so prepare yourself accordingly. When I learned of Stalin's crimes and those of his genocidal comrades around the world, I already knew a little about the Greek and Roman democracies of the ancient world. But I was not then aware that the Swiss had more recently adopted some of their ideas. I went on to look closely at the direct democracy of ancient Athens, studying Pericles, his leadership, and the Peloponnesian War. However, I would only learn of the new hybrid years later when serving in the army in Germany, thinking little more about it until I left the military in 1997. I retired as a major with wide experience in carrying out a variety of roles in strategic and tactical intelligence gathering operations. When I packed my beret away for the last time, I would turn my attention towards identifying ways to improve the political system in which we live. Up until then, as a military man, I could not be directly involved in politics, but this was going to change. Having been born in Germany and brought up in countries around the world as a military brat, and later earning German Army parachute wings and gaining exposure to another nation's military as an exchange officer, I was ready to take the next step in the simple life plan I had put together prior to going to the UK's Army Officer Training Academy at Sandhurst in 1981. Before joining up, I had worked as a door-to-door commission-only salesman and manager, choosing this field as a personal test and a means to overcome my shyness and fear of public speaking. I had wanted to serve in the military from an early age, but had understood that I lacked the confidence to project myself and inspire others to follow me. I also wanted no regrets at 40 when I looked back on what I had done with my life, as that seemed like a very advanced age to me when I was 18. The awareness of my weaknesses and my desire to succeed led me to read a classic Dale Carnegie self-help manual, which encouraged me to take the plunge into direct sales, as I saw this as a shock cure for my lack of confidence. I would just have to grit my teeth and persevere through my embarrassments until I got used to meeting strangers and talking to them. It was a tough time, with fear-bulging eyes and breathless doorstep interrogations greeting the unfortunate victims of my experiment, but it was a necessary preparation for the officer selection process I would have to face. Happily, it largely worked, and along the way, I became a sales manager, and I have always appreciated and benefited from the personal changes that followed from screwing up enough courage to face my fears when I was still young. However, the vestiges of my true nature and introversion remain, ever happy to be alone and reading a book, or heading off on a solitary trek over the hills. Before I took the physical, mental, and leadership tests involved in officer selection, I had come up with a simple plan for my life ahead. I had realized that when it came to work, I could only get motivated when doing something that I enjoyed or found interesting, hence my commitment to the military. I was challenged by what I thought the Army had to offer and the leadership skills it would develop in me, and I knew that these would be useful throughout my life. I only planned to be in the military to combat communism and other threats, as repayment of the debt I felt I owed to my granddad, the reluctant soldier, and those who trod alongside him. I also thought of it as something to do when I was young enough to cope with the physical challenges, after which I could move on and use the training and experience as the platform for a business career, finishing off with involvement in politics as an activist and writer. All this presumed that I survived, but I accepted the challenge and took my chances. Today, we see young graduates throwing themselves into politics with little experience to back up the book learning, with the older professional narcissists of this type, like Biden, hanging on too long and leading us to disaster. Anyway, this is what I planned, needing little more detail as I found writing out weekly and monthly goals to be of little use, but the general four-step life plan survived the years. It guided my work efforts, keeping me focused on the long game and providing me with the results I hoped for, while a simple daily to-do list sufficed to fill in the spaces between the four long-term phases. Besides real-life tragedies that knocked me sideways and still echo on down the years, I can say that I have rarely suffered from anything that stopped me from sleeping as soon as my head hit the pillow, and misery never extended its grip on my innards too long. I think that the basic outline plan helped me to focus on where I wanted to go and kept me on course when things went awry, and this has done more for my mental conditioning and stability than anything else. What I learned at Sandhurst of the Master Principle supported this too, but more on that later. My father had taught electronic engineering at the RAF Technical School, and I still reflect on observations he made about making informed decisions, following on from the experiences he had whilst studying at night school for his higher national diploma. He explained that when a business boss came in and told the class about the problems he had with staff, he had agreed with him. Then, when the union fellow came in on another day and explained the problems he had with the management, he agreed with him too. Finding the middle ground, the sweet spot that works best for most of us, is never easy, but ideologies and preconceptions do seem to trump sensible discussion even more these days than they did in my dad's time, hence the craziness. I didn't appreciate everything my dad did, but I did like his practical approach, and I have always been interested in science, in facts, and the search for answers. Later in life, I would read Thomas Kuhn and Karl Popper on the philosophy of science, and Darwin and many others on evolution and the world around us. These studies have helped strip away any illusions I had about my own magnificent self, humbling me, but releasing me at the same time too. When the man who some see as the outstanding philosopher of the 20th century, Karl Popper, can routinely state to one of his associates that "we don't know anything," Meiji 2002, PPR 243-250, I think we can all drop our guards and learn to listen attentively and think more deeply. While we are on Popper, his amazing two-volume work, The Open Society and Its Enemies, Popper 2011, is worth whatever time you can give to it. At times, as I read through it, I can honestly say that I felt that I was looking into the brain of a man much sharper than I. Not too difficult, I know. I did not always understand what he was saying, but read on in fascination at the breadth of his thought and the depth of his knowledge of many disciplines. It is a foundational work on anti-totalitarian thinking, and where he is not covering complex specialist material, he is a wonderful writer of clear and understandable English, a delight to read. His belief in the value of experience, the need for small-scale and localized experiments where social change is tested and engineered, spoke volumes for his good sense and foresight. Even though he was apparently a most intolerant champion of tolerance, nicknamed the totalitarian liberal, you would never know this when reading his works. Maji, 2002, p. 232. However, what he said about tolerance is worth restating. Unlimited tolerance must lead to the disappearance of tolerance. If we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed, and tolerance with them. In this formulation, I do not imply, for instance, that we should always suppress the utterance of intolerant philosophies. As long as we can counter them by rational argument and keep them in check by public opinion, suppression would certainly be unwise. But we should claim the right to suppress them if necessary, even by force, for it may easily turn out that they are not prepared to meet us on the level of rational argument, but begin by denouncing all argument. They may forbid their followers to listen to rational argument because it is deceptive, and teach them to answer arguments by the use of their fists or pistols. We should therefore claim, in the name of tolerance, the right not to tolerate the intolerant. Popper, 2017. Sadly, his good advice and clarity of thinking are not to the taste of the intolerant caste doing their best to steer our public affairs today, a problem of the first order and indicative of their arrogance, and a danger to us all. One of Britain's foremost historians from the past, E.H. Carr, wrote a 14-volume history of the Soviet Union and was more of an old liberal than an out-and-out lefty, and his thoughts on the issue of left and right ring true, but don't quite capture the nastiness of the hard left. However, bearing that in mind, his quote comes close to defining why we need the hard center to wake up and take over from the edge of the spectrum nutters. The left is foolish and the right is vicious. Carr, 1984, PhD. I think that we have tolerated being misled and messed around quite long enough. It's necessary now to take the reins and push the parties into the seats behind us, where they always should have been and must remain. As I approach the end of this personal chapter, which I hope has made clear my prejudices and biases, I will fully declare my undying opposition to those involved in corrupting politics, especially those clustered at the dangerous ends of the utopia-seeking and psychopathic spectrums. Whilst healthy competition is vital to all of us in enjoying life, work, and progress, the prissy utopians and conscienceless and focused psychopaths recognize few boundaries in these areas. Political parties and taxpayer-funded institutions are the honeyed targets of these wily and malevolent operators, undermining our systems, corrupting officials, and destroying the lives of the weakest among us in search of their global visions and personal aims. Working behind closed doors, they have pretty much destroyed the representative system and made it very clear to me that the hybrid system of democracy is needed without delay. It is only when the powerful have to face the fact that they cannot pay off the entire voting bloc will they back off from twisting arms and purchasing favors. Anyone thinking otherwise is naive in the extreme and should read what follows with open eyes and a discerning mind. If they can discount the statements from many presidents and leading figures that I quote in support of my assertions, I look forward to hearing from them. As a former intelligence analyst, I am naturally wary of making bold assertions without proof from decent sources and with corroboration of the information from similarly reliable informants. This is why this volume has taken time to prepare, to ensure that I had evidence that I found convincing and credible before I would present it to you. It's always possible that I have been misled somewhere, but the facts will generally speak for themselves, and the picture that emerges should be unaffected by picking at a single thread here and possibly another there. For those not familiar with the different standards of evidence required in a court or on the desk of an intelligence officer, some explanation is in order. The police need evidence that can survive the scrutiny of cross-examination by a capable barrister in front of a jury. They have time to examine it closely and weigh it carefully before presenting their case. Well, that's the theory. Use of evidence is different in an army intelligence outfit, as they will often not have the luxury of time to check and corroborate information with other sources, but they may still need to guide a decision maker or brief a team deploying within a matter of hours on a dangerous operation, and will have to do so on the thin gruel they have been fed. Thus, decisions in this far from ideal world often must be made on the simple weightings of probability and possibility. If you seek certainty, that world is not for you, and maybe that is why I like Popper so much. One of the latest system scams linked to intelligence is intelligence-led policing. This is cover for politically inclined policing, targeting some elements to suggest something is being done, but often ignoring favored scallywags, hence the failure to deal with Antifa in the US and the misnamed Asian rape gangs in the UK. It is often just more tosh from those aiming to retain power and to weaken those not willing to bow and scrape before the globalist god. Earlier on, I mentioned the power of the three-word meme, favored by Lenin, and the use of three does seem to have a peculiar power in several fields, even in law. Lawyers are taught to use three parts to an argument when presenting evidence, so much so that if they don't have a third element, they are told to make it up. This might be to do with our reasoning skills. Anything can happen once, twice could be a coincidence, but three times, well, you are banged to rights and guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Jacob Rees-Mogg MP also mentions that it is a standard tool used by the Etonian and Oxford Union bunch to spin their lines to us. Some of the routine oratorical tricks I probably picked up at Oxford, the obsession with everything coming in threes, that sort of thing. Cooper, 2022, p. 87. Lenin also told the three great lies to gain power after the February 1917 revolution, to which the Bolsheviks were late comers. This first revolution started when women protested for their rights on International Women's Day and demanded food because of the horrendous shortages at the time. Lenin then took advantage of the chaos to prepare for and win the second, the October, revolution with his three big porkies, lies. He promised the workers that the factories would be theirs, that the land would be handed over to the peasants, and that peace would be agreed, thus appeasing the soldiers. Of course, Lenin planned none of these, as the state would use the Soviets to take over the factories. It would collectivize the land and kill off the kulaks, and planned an international war to bring Europe the benefits of the gulags. Sorry, socialism. He also omitted to mention the planned genocide of the upper classes, hence the omission of class genocide, vetoed by the guilty Soviets when the Genocide Convention came into effect after World War II. Note, no veto for the people, just the genocidaires themselves. Rogers, 2023. I am obviously simplifying things here, but anything coming in threes does seem to hold a special power. If we take control, and we must, of our countries, we can end the US political system's submission to the military-industrial complex, the UK Parliament's forelock tugging to the party controllers, and the Chinese people's terror of the Red Prince offspring of the Communist Party's officials. All now reap status, untold billions, and real power from us, including that over life and death. This must stop now, and you, yes you, are vital in ensuring that it does.